It's creating a web of connections between the haves and the have-nots, the privileged and the underprivileged, between that community and this community, to have a holistic community, all contributing towards joy and concern and caring and everything. So that kind of opening up and connectivity, it can happen.
Creating a web of connections, that is certainly a dream worth dreaming. Let us wish for it to come true. This is Smita Ramanathan with Manju Venkat saying goodbye from Bangalore, India. Thank you for listening.
WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service, was co-founded by Catherine Davenport and Frieda Worden in 1986. For more about our weekly programming and extensive archives, email wings@wings.org. WINGS thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange, and other works on the gift economy. She hosts salons at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The WINGS sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you now through April 15th at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means that we are funded by you, our listener. And you happen to be listening to KBOO Portland during our All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 special programming campaign, going on now through April. Check our listing of specials at kboo.fm/ATNF. This morning, we are joined by Matthew, host of the monthly bedtime stories program Gremlin Time, to discuss the new DVD of The Devil and Daniel Webster. But first, we welcome Shanna Hammonds to share her enthusiasm for the Thin Man series.
You cannot put your Gnostic device there.
Madam.
Women and children first, boys.
Say, what is the score, anyway?
Oh, so it's you he was after.
Hello, sugar.
He's dragged me into every gin mill on the block.
Yeah, I had him out this morning.
I thought so.
Something that you're greatly fond of as a series.
Definitely a big fan.
You're a big fan, and I'm a big fan of the films, too, but also of Dashiell Hammett. Apparently, I've been mispronouncing his name for 40 years. And I'll concentrate on him. But first, let's explore the movies themselves, when they came out and who's in them and what it is that you find so attractive and appealing about these films.
I thought so.
Oh, this is Tommy, my wife.
How are you?
How do you do?
Tommy, I don't usually look like this. I've been Christmas shopping.
Madam, I'm afraid we shall take the dog out.
Oh, it's all right, Joe. It's all right. It's my dog. And my wife.
Well, you might have mentioned me first on the billing.
The dog's well trained. He'll behave himself.
It might bite some.
Well, oh, he's all right. So I'll say that my mom and dad are both movie buffs, and growing up, that's kind of a thing that we did together, is we watched movies together. And my mom is definitely a huge classics, like Turner Classic Movies fan.
Mm-hmm.
So, already kind of was familiar, you know, with black and white movies just from growing up. And also growing up, I can't remember, like, that's this idea of very quick dialogue that maybe. I feel like we don't always have in movies so much.
My wife, this is Dorothy Wynan.
How do you do? I'm sorry we have to rush.
See, we're stopping in the Normandy for a couple of weeks. Drop around, see us.
Well, we'd love to. Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Sit down, sugar. Oh, Leo. Yes,
pretty girl.
Yeah, she's a very nice type.
You got types?
Only you, darling.
Lanky brunettes with wicked jaws. Leo, compliments this season.
Who is she?
Oh, darling, I was hoping I wouldn't have to answer that.
Come on.
Well, Dorothy is really my daughter. You see, it was spring in Venice, and I was so young I didn't know what I was doing. We're all like that on my father's side.
By the way, how is your father's side?
Oh, it's much better, thanks. And yours?
Say, how many drinks have you had?
This will make 6 martinis.
All right. Will you bring me 5 more martinis? Leo, line them right up here.
Yes, ma'am.
And in this time when these movies were coming out, like, it was still very, talkies were new, right? Like, this idea of seeing someone and having them talk in real time was kind of like a new experience.
And yeah, as of about 1929 to 1931, yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like people were still expecting the, like, quick, snappy dialogue of, like, radio dramas. So mm-hmm. I love that they have that.
Yeah.
You know?
And they're so briskly written and well shot, and they're so the funny, and also the perfect casting of William Powell and Myrna Loy as the Mr. and Mrs.
Charles, Nick and Nora Charles.
Nick and Nora Charles. Boy, how could I forget that? These films were based on one novel by Dashiell Hammett called The Thin Man. It's funny. The Thin Man in the novel is simply a person who has gone missing, and that's what they nickname him. So it has nothing to do with Nick Charles or even anything about his career. It's just somebody who's been missing, and there's concern about where he's gone to. But the book had such rich, funny dialogue itself that it was really appealing to Hollywood, which at that time was always looking for playwrights and radio writers and even novelists, anybody who could write snappy dialogue. But also that it blends genres. It's a mystery, but also a romance of marriage.
Yeah, mostly and, comedy, I think. Yeah,
and also they have such great chemistry mm-hmm. that it inspired MGM, the studio, to get 5 more? So I think there's 7 in all.
I think there's 6.
Okay, 6.
But there is like a documentary, and I know this because one year I got the DVD set of
Nice.
And it includes a 7th movie that's a documentary about Myrna Loy and William Powell. But I have not seen it yet. Because I don't have a DVD player.
Yeah. Oh, that's too bad. Well,
in modern living, we stream it all now.
I know. Well, so the plot of The Thin Man is simply that a scientist has gone missing, and the daughter of the scientist has employed her old friend,
who worked for the scientist on a case years before.
Yes.
That's the connection.
Right. And so often in the mysteries, there's a family connection of some kind. People are seeking him out or seeking out the wife to ask Mr. Charles to do something. And yeah. then while he's doing this case, it's like he knows everybody from every strata of society. For example, in the one set in San Francisco, which is where he's from, the mm-hmm. character is from, every time he gets into a cab, he knows the cabbie. Every time a gangster comes out of nowhere, he's the one who put him away. But they're all so fun and friendly with each other. And part of the appeal of the story, I think, is that here's a guy from the world of crime and roughness and intrigue, while his wife is a millionaire. She's mm-hmm. from an extremely well-off family, and she has that finely honed mid-Atlantic accent, that well-educated sound. And so he's pretty sophisticated too. I'm glad that they chose not to make him more of a roughneck, that he's a suave Cary Grant type. And so he's able to mix into both levels of the society that he's in. But yes, he retired from being a private detective when he married his millionaire wife. And so a lot of people haven't seen him for a while because there have been no cases that he's been covering.
Goodbye. Nice to have met you. Take slow down. I can't keep up with you going.
Excuse me, lady. I guess I wasn't looking where I was going.
No, I guess you weren't.
Hiya, Fingers.
Well, well, Nick Charles. Well, how are you?
Fine. How's business, Fingers?
Business? Oh, I quit that racket.
Nick, my purse. It's gone.
Oh, that's a shame. All right, I want you to meet Fingers McCoy. This is my wife, Fingers.
Your wife?
Mm-hmm.
Say, I didn't know she was... Oh, I'm sorry about your purse, Mrs. Charles.
What'll I do, Nick? I know I had it with me.
Oh, it'll turn up. Won't it, Fingers?
I certainly hope so. Sure. Well, so long, Nick. Glad I bumped into you. Goodbye, Mrs. Charles.
Goodbye. Nick, I've got to go back to the train.
No, I wouldn't bother, darling. Let's get home.
I just can't go off.
Come on now, come on. You don't want to embarrass him, do you?
What do you mean?
Fingers, he's a purse snatcher. Think of his feelings.
A purse snatcher? Well, he must have taken it.
Certainly, but you see, he didn't know you were my wife. You'll get it back in the morning mail, darling. He's a very honest pickpocket.
Oh, Nick, you do know the nicest people.
Hiya, Nick. Welcome home.
Hiya, Bumps. How's the boy?
Ever better, Nick. In the pink.
See you around.
A prize fighter, darling?
No, a wrestler.
Oh, a wrestler. Well, that's different.
Hiya, Nicky. What's a good boy?
Well, hello, Slats. How's everything?
I'm doing okay. Glad to see you, pal.
Likewise.
Now, there's a sweet character. He ought to be in jail just to play safe.
He got out last Tuesday.
Oh. Welcome home, Nora. Oh, hello. Thank you.
Nice to see you, my dear.
Thank you very much.
Now, who are those people, darling?
You wouldn't know them. They're respectable.
Oh.
What I like about the movies, they don't all take place in New York, but I like that when they do, it's kind of like the city is another character. Like, it's really one of those where the main character is the city. They do all the movies. They all have one of his favorite, he being Nick Charles. I swear his favorite way to, like, solve the crime is to get everybody together in a room.
Yes.
And that's always you know what I mean? That's always the way they do it in each of the movies. There's a, like, now we're going to get everybody together in a room and see how they react to, you know, him being kind of ridiculous,
right,
provocative, which is fun.
That goes back to the British murder mysteries, such as Agatha Christie and others, who do that, like the gathering the people together. And it goes all the way up to shows like Monk, where his catchphrase was, here's what happened, you know, when he's gathering, all the people have gathered, and he sets out the true order of events. But yeah, that's my favorite part too, the gathering of all of the suspects. And I have to say that when I first saw them, I was fooled several times.
You thought somebody else had done it, you mean?
Either that or I had no idea who did it.
Oh.
I was especially surprised when a particular actor who later...
Oh, I know. Yes. Okay. You can't... Nope. You know what? If you say any more, you're going to ruin it. I feel like that's just... you're going to spoil it.
You're right. You're right. Yeah. I can't even...
Yeah. But can I say something about the Thin Man that I learned when I was reading the book, rereading the book, because the book is really fun, and I think you'd like to read, you know, recommending that book, that then several different screenwriters just kind of like went wild with those characters.
Yes.
He also wrote The Maltese Falcon, and he made plenty of money off that book and that movie, right?
Right.
And so they had already like paid him for another book, and this story goes that he's hanging out with his wife, living it up in a hotel in New York City with Pinkertons outside waiting to snag him, because everybody knows, including the owners of the hotel, that he can't afford to pay his bill.
Mm.
And it's before the crash that this happened, supposedly. Right. So the way that he sneaks out is that he like puts on a ton of different overcoats and makes himself appear to be a larger man. And everybody's looking for this skinny guy, because apparently he was like a tall, skinny guy.
Right.
And like, you know, he kind of stoops over and he uses a cane and like uses, you know, whatever else. He used to be a Pinkerton himself. So then they use that ploy, in the movie, The Thin Man, it's also when they find the body and it's like, oh, it must have been a big guy. Look at the size of that belt. Whoa. And you know, should we really assume that just because the belt's there?
Right.
that's right. And so that's part of the title. But I didn't realize that the book was supposedly really autobiographical. And I love that the intro to the book talked about how when the book came out and a lot of people were struggling, this idea of like a life that, frankly, like nobody can live on the Nick and Nora Charles diet. I'm sorry.
No.
Like you can't wake up and be chugging martinis and like maybe have an egg with your headache and a little coffee and then go off to have like another five martinis at lunch. And, it, you know, like you just live a ridiculous life. But the point was made that it was sort of a like kindness, you know, to like give people this idea of a fantasy of like it up in a hotel and like drinking as much as you want and like all of the excitement. And Nick has the connections from his time as a private eye, and like Nora has the money and the prestige, and she's so curious and, you know, friendly that even when she's a little disproving, people still accept her. It's not like she becomes a target, except that one, like, and I think it's the second movie where she gets pickpocketed. They're getting off a train. Nick, my purse is gone. My purse. Oh, it's fine. Don't worry about it. And then like finds a way to hand her her purse back because
That's funny.
Who knew was the pickpocket.
Exactly. Nick, I haven't seen you in years. Well, also there's a really nice moment in the first film where some suspect, a gangster type, has sneaked into their apartment or their hotel room, and he's got a gun, and Nick needs to get the gun away from him, but his method is to distract the thug by punching his wife.
That's how he gets her out of the way.
Get her out of the way. And, but then when she gets up, she says, "I knew you were going to take him. I just wanted to see you do it." And it is a measure of their compatibility that they take such joy in each other's behaviors and have such faith in their what they're doing.
I mean, he teases, he locks her in closets, you know, like there's definitely like there's far more of him outwitting her, I will say. Yeah. Although there are some fun scenes, like there's a moment in one of the later films where they have a son where they're like in, Nick and Nick Jr. are in Central Park reading. And of course it looks like they're reading a fairy tale book, but like it's actually the day's race report for the worker. And she just starts shaking like a cocktail shaker. And then all of a sudden he goes, he's like, "Nikki, I don't know why, but I have a feeling that something very important is happening. I need to be there."
Two other components that I think are delightful. Well, not necessarily delightful, but Asta, the dog, and then also their drinking habits, which they present comically, but you know that they would not be able to survive very long on, as you just said.
That's what makes it a fantasy.
Yeah, she'll track him down in a hotel bar, and she'll ask how many martinis he has had, and then she asks for the same number lined up. Boy, I don't know how they could have done it. But in any case, it's just a fantasy. It's a kind of a New Yorkerish Algonquin hotel quality of Manhattan nightlife, I guess. But Asta has perceptual skills beyond the ken of any normal dog.
Yes, but also is not necessarily a guard dog all
not
the time.
Not at all.
Right?
No.
Not really at all. Like, you know, frequently getting in trouble for running away, like when the gangster gets into the room because Nora just thought he was there to see Nick, you know?
Yeah. You're reminding me that I think that the Asta dog also appeared in Bringing Up Baby, the Howard Hawks film.
Oh.
Catherine Hepburn and Cary Grant. There's a scene where a bone is involved in this ridiculous.
Oh yeah, part. with the whatever the big cat is. I forget what kind of cat it is. Is
a
it
a leopard? I think it's a leopard. No. Okay. But anyway, there's a great big bone out there, and the Asta dog finds it and saves the day at one point. Bringing the Baby is a little meaner in tone and much more cruel to the Cary Grant character, who's kind of a bubbling boffin type. But Nick Charles movies, they're fun, they're delightful. They're meant to provide a sense of joy and intrigue at the same time.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of over-the-top kind of like extra New York accent. I mean, one thing I notice in the movies is the cops are always kind of like blithering idiots. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They give them like a thick accent from one of the boroughs. And I feel like the first Lieutenant Abrams, but I don't remember, you know, like he's got a pretty thick accent. He's in a couple of the movies and he's always like, what do we do? You know, like they take their clues from, we got a problem with that. Why do we got a problem with that? Like they take their cues from Nick, even though he's forever being like, I am not part of this. I'm not involved.
Well, when you're dealing with Hollywood and especially a studio such as MGM, you have such a wealth of character actors from which to draw to flesh out these interesting characters that keep popping up. And the director for several of them was a guy named Woody Van Dyke. Mm-hmm. And his nickname was One Take Woody because he just would zip through the shooting of a film, get him done within several weeks. So these are these are delightful films, mm-hmm. and well, I guess we got to get people to think about getting the DVD set. I didn't know there was a DVD set of just the Thin Man series.
Yeah.
Especially for that documentary, I'd love to see that.
I know.
So we're talking to Shanna Hammonds about the complete set of Thin Man movies starring William Powell and Myrna Loy, and initially based on the novel The Thin Man by Dashiell Hammett, and then Hammett wrote the idea for the second movie, and then his participation was simply collecting the money so he could...
live in hotels with his wife. It sounds like they were more or less Nick and Nora having a great time.
That's true. I think that's really true. So anyway, thanks for joining us and talking about all this. And I hope that I gave you a chance to say everything that you wanted to say about the movies.
I do feel a bit remiss because I feel like we should have started by suggesting that it's kind of inappropriate to watch the movies or even talk about the movies without a cocktail or a mocktail. So we probably should have started with that, but that's fine. If you
next
know,
time the thinking
the listeners don't have one, now is the time.
Yes.
You take any lesson from them.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Shanna. And
we will
talk very, very soon. Now I'm going to cease the recording. Thanks, Shanna. And you're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. And don't forget, KBOO Portland's All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign is going on right now through April. Again, check our list of specials at kboo.fm/ATNF4 during this campaign. We thank our listeners. So here we are again with Matthew of Gremlin Time. And he's really excited to talk to us about a movie that has several titles. We're just going to refer to it as The Devil and Daniel Webster, but it's found on the Criterion Collection as All That Money Can Buy from 1941 from RKO Studios and directed by William Dieterle and starring Edward Arnold and John Huston's father, Walter Huston.
Now, I came across this movie once as a kid on television. It's one of these films, like, you know, it's an old movie, and then it's doing all these magical things in it, and you don't know what the movie is. I had to look it up in the TV guide later, but I've sort of always remembered this film, and then later came across it in that Illustrated History of Horror Movies by Clarence. And you got to hand it to Walter Huston. He does a great performance in this as the devil. And some people think that this is like a sort of American version of Goethe's Faust.
Yeah, it depends on the influence on Stephen Vincent Benet, who was the author of the original short story that appeared, I don't know, in the Saturday Evening Post or somewhere. And he was a supremely popular writer at the time. It was an easy decision to make to adapt the story into a movie, but they didn't make it easy on themselves because they hired so many terrific actors and got one of the best cinematographers who was very versed in the film noirish look. And it's mostly on a closed set that's not in the outside world, so they can really control the lighting and the wind and other things. But it is a story about a guy who makes a deal with the devil. But in this case, he's just an ordinary guy. He's not an intellectual. And the devil approaches him.
Cunt. But that's enough to make a man sell his soul to the devil. And I would for about 2 cents.
Because he's got a nose for sniffing out people in trouble.
Who are you? My name is Scratch. I often go by that name in New England.
I don't have any business with you.
Who might be tempted?
Do you deny that you called me? I've known people in other states who went back on their word, but I
I didn't expect it in New Hampshire.
You can't say that to me. I'm New Hampshire. And if I say I called you, I did.
Guess I did.
By this contract that traps him.
You've had a lot of bad luck these days. And yet, it's all so unnecessary. When I think of your opportunities.
My opportunities?
Of course. My man, you have one of the richest farms in the county. You just go about it the wrong way. So many men do. Hard work. That's all right for people who don't know how to do anything else. It's all right for people who aren't lucky. But once you're lucky, you don't have to work for other people. You make them work for you.
Walter Houston plays the devil, and he plays it like a flim-flam man.
Yes.
Who travels around and causes scams and cheats people out of their money. And he has a little book. Now, this movie's gone through different versions. A lot of scenes were taken out at the beginning of it and then released under a different title. And so this Criterion collection is the most complete collection. Yes. Of the original film, which I think it was just one of these films where it had a very serious message. And it just, because there was no real clear release or way to promote it, it just gets kind of shuffled around and put into the background and didn't get seen. Though I think it's a very influential movie because it's using the techniques that Orson Welles had used in Citizen Kane and then his next picture, Magnificent Ambersons. And this is from the same studio. And so here's somebody else using the same strange camera angles and the self-conscious camera movements and very distinct sets and everything to tell a story in an obvious, this is a movie telling a story as opposed to the traditional way of trying to, you know, make the movie, the editing disappear and the people aren't aware of it. Whereas Citizen Kane really made you aware that you're watching a movie.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
And so these techniques would be picked up. This movie may not be that well famous, but I think it really affected Hollywood, and it showed how you could start telling stories a little bit differently, especially with these films in the 40s where they're delving more into the psychological and the inner space. So in the 30s, I think this is Bordwell's book I'm talking about, where he talks about how in the 30s it was about the person coming to grips with the world, whereas in the 40s it's more coming to grips with yourself or realization, something like that, and the emergence of the horror movies. And this movie has elements very much like a horror movie, the lighting, the strange camera angles. So if we're going to make an analogy to Faust, it would be way of F.W. Murnau's version of Faust.
Yeah.
And Murnau had come over, and Dietrich was started in Germany, and he's one of these lesser known film directors who came over in the early 30s. And he was a nice programmer. He did a few, well known hits. He did Duel in the Sun and Portrait of Jenny.
But his career kind of drifted away, and he returned to Europe after the war.
Yeah.
But this is an example of Americana, as is Magnificent Ambersons, and a lot of the movies from Republic and elsewhere, stories about country life. And apparently, after the 30s, nobody really liked that genre as much anymore. And one of the ways that the cinematography, detracts to what would be normally a fluffy Americana presentation is by making it gloomy and a little bit scary. Yeah. And then there's this terrible villain, Mr. Scratch, who's never called the devil. In fact, the devil's only mentioned once and not even in connection with Mr. Scratch. But, that was a condition of trying to prevent Southern theaters from rejecting the movie out of hand because it would scare away the more religious Southern states.
So it's a nice little historic piece. It's a nice little drama. It's a piece of propaganda. But it's also a kind of foreteller of where movies were going.
That's true. And it's beautifully photographed and production designed, as we've mentioned. And it also would not be the same movie if the score had not been written by Bernard Herrmann, who went on to win his, I believe, only Oscar for this really great score of Americana-style music.
So it's out now as a new disc from Criterion. You might want to check it out.
Thank you, Matthew, for joining us and talking about this. And we're going to talk about some more stuff a little bit later this spring.
Once again, thank you, Matthew. And thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching the screens.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.